Okay, just I'll briefly introduce our guest speaker. And the format of the evening is basically Rabbi Linzer and Dr. Malamud are each going to speak for 10, 15 minutes on the Akedah. And they're going to sort of respond to each other for a few minutes and sort of open it up to questions, have a discussion on what's obviously a central text and raises many, many issues. But just by way of introduction, I want to introduce Rabbi Linzer. This is actually, I mentioned, this is the sixth time he'll be speaking over Shabbos. But by the time he finishes, it'll be Sunday, so it's okay. Rabbi Linzer is the Rosh Yeshiva and Dean of Yeshivat Chol Vevei Torah, the rabbinic school. It's been around now for 13 years. They've got over 80 graduates in the field, and over 95% of them are still involved in Klei Kodesh, about half in the pulpit, others in Hillel, in Chinuch. Rabbi Linzer learned in Har Etzion in Israel, got smicha from the Israeli chief rabbinate, learned in the Kollel Elyon at Yeshiva University, and was the Rosh Kollel in Boca Raton. When Rabbi Brander, who now is in Yeshiva University, when he was the rabbi in Boca Raton, he brought Rabbi Linzer to head up the Kollel there for a couple of years, and that eventually, I think, is the genesis of what's become the Yeshiva University Kollel, which is here in Toronto, thanks to Eli Rubenstein, and and he's been running now at Chol Vevei for 13 years, developing the Smicha program, dealing with the issues of being Orthodox rabbi in the modern world. I think that's, if I can summarize, to confront some of the very, very hard issues that we deal with out in the field. And it's been a pleasure hearing him all weekend. And Dr. Malamud, of course, who needs no introduction, but I'm sure everybody here has heard him. And insightful speaker. And, of course, we are colleagues not only in Torah Motion, family get together, but we teach together in chat. Elliot also teaches at York, and we look forward to an interesting evening on a very important topic. Thank you very much.
So just to give you a prelude, when I was going over this topic with Rabbi Linzer earlier this week, I sent him a bunch of questions that I thought relate to the basic sort of moral quandaries that are inherent in this story. We're not going to get to all those questions, but these are just some of the things we were thinking about. And they are, given the number of prohibitions in Tanakh about child sacrifice, is Hashem sort of breaking his own rules in this story? How can God order a person to kill his own child? Why does Avram obey? Is the obedience troubling, especially sort of the muteness of his response in the original text? Is obedience to God's will so supreme a value as to override all other values? How is God served by this? And more topically, why do we read this on Rosh Hashanah? Is it a story that really resonates even for the most religious modern reader on Yamim Noraim? And if it's a story about faith, is it a triumph of faith over rationality? And essentially, like, what kind of paradigm is this for Jewish belief? So those are the questions that I sent, and we'll see what we can do.
Okay, thank you. So there's obviously a great deal to discuss here. I'll say, I think, some key framing comments, and then I'm sure more will emerge in the ongoing conversation and discussion. I think first it's worth noting, of course, that the relevance of this for this time of year is both that it's the Kriyat HaTorah for one of the days of Rosh Hashanah, and often we certainly associate the Tkiyat Shofar with the Ram of Yitzchak. It's worth noting, though, that that association is late in the Talmudic period. A lot of discussion about what types of horns are used and what type of animals, and the association with the Ram of Yitzchak comes relatively late. But certainly for us, this Akedat Yitzchak is a very central theme. It's also interesting to note that after Rosh Hashanah, it actually continues to play a theme in the Slichot, that in one of the Slichot, which is called the Akedah, on Erev Rosh Hashanah, but then we have an Akedah in the Slichot leading from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippurim. So certainly it seems to be chosen to express some aspect of this period that really is something that we should be turning to, embodying, or living up to as a model. And of course that raises questions about what is the religious message that we are supposed to be learning and aspiring to in terms of the Akedah. Now, I think that nowadays we assume that the actual test of the Akedah was that the challenge of the test for many of us, I think, is will Avraham listen to a command by God to essentially commit murder, to violate a profound sort of moral principle, and will his belief in God and his sense of obedience to God override his sense of morality and what's right and wrong, and that was the test, and that somehow he succeeded or he passed the test by listening to God and saying that following God takes precedence over our moral dictates. It's worth noting that that really is the framing that we are heirs to because of Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard, in his book Fear and Trembling, frames the Akedah exactly in those terms. Do we have a suspension of the ethical for the sake of the divine command? Does our sort of religious identity or religious imperative win out over our moral one? But it's a serious question whether that really is the way the Torah is framing it and the way that we have embodied it or transmitted it through our liturgy. If in the story of the Torah, you never hear the sense of that Avraham is being asked to commit murder. That's not something that somehow emerges. I mean, it's what we read and hear in the story, maybe, but it's not in the text. What you hear is, Kach et bincha yichidcha asher ahavta, take the son, your one son, your beloved son, and offer him up to me. And then at the end of the story, God says, now I know that, ki yirei Elohim ata, because you were not chasachtes binchas yichidcha mimeni. You didn't hold him back. Now I know you fear God because your belief in God is more important than your commitment to morality, but that you are willing to give to me, God, that which is most dear to you. That seems to be the message in the Torah. And if you actually look in the tefillah, for those that say the Akedah in the morning in the Psukei Dezimra, which is probably a very small percentage of Klal Yisrael, but there is the Akedah pre-Psukei Dezimra section, the Korbanot section. So first of all, it's interesting to note that it's in the Korbanot section, maybe a point I'll return to. And here, after we read the Akedah, we say the following. Ribono shel olam, yiratzon milfanecha, Hashem Elokeinu b'lokei avoteinu, shetizkor lanu brit avoteinu, kemo shekavash Avraham Avinu et rachamav, miben yichido, v'ratza lishchot oto kedei lasot ratzonecha. Kein yichpashu rachames chaschatz chmei aleinu, v'yigol rachamach midotecha. The same way Avraham was willing to overcome his feeling of parental compassion and mercy to do your will, so you, God, should be willing to overcome your sense of justice in order to have compassion on us. And the message there, again, seems to be, look what Avraham was willing to do. He was willing to give up everything that was most dear to him to serve God. That seems to be sort of shot, if you would, for, I believe, of the message of the story in the Torah and how it's sort of been transmitted in the liturgy. The problem is that it's very hard for us nowadays to just accept that at face value, particularly the fact that besides that we are perhaps more sensitive to that sense of the moral conflict. I think that if we just believe it at the time, this is, I think, a point that Hirsch makes, at the time when the Akedah was commanded, child sacrifice was not remarkable. That was pretty standard in pagan traditions. So it would not have necessarily raised ethical concerns at the time. Our sense of what is moral and what is ethical is very contingent, upon our historical and societal setting. Nowadays, that we think these things are horrific, like slavery of other human beings was for thousands of years assumed completely morally acceptable, even by the, you know, great moralists of the time and ethicists of the time. And I think sometimes we are a little naive or would like to believe that these, you know, that these moral truths were always moral truths. So at the time, probably it was not seen as so much something immoral, but it was seen as asking for the giving of what is most great. But the problem is, can we continue reading it that way nowadays? Because nowadays, certainly, we, you know, it seems that you're asking for murder for the sake of serving God. And besides the fact that how do we deal with that as, given that we do feel that this is a absolute moral principle, even if we can accept that at times it was not seen that way. And beyond that, of course, is in the period where there is, religious fanaticism, and we see that people are willing to give up not their only their lives, but give up the lives of others and take the lives of others in the name of serving God. And that, unfortunately, we have really, you know, seen more and more in that these days. But, you know, it's been with us for at least 1,000 years, if not more. Can we continue to transmit that message, you know, unproblematically? And the answer seems certainly not. You know, if we keep on holding up the Akedah as a symbol, even if we try to say, no, the message is just we give up things that are dear for us to serve God. Well, if we don't problematize it, then we're also transmitting the message that you can commit murder if that's what you believe that God has commanded you. So it becomes really a question about how do we, even if we can accept maybe what's a pshat and would have been acceptable in a particular context, how do we transmit it? How do we teach it? And I think that's an important question. You know, I teach the Daf Yomi Shiur on a regular basis, and sometimes we encounter things that can be disturbing, like certain statements that are very, you know, negative about non-Jews and so on. And, you know, what I tell my shiurs, well, you have to understand, you know, the realities about where Chazal were living, and they were subject to the persecution by the Romans and so on. And the basic response that they say, that I hear from some people is, okay, I don't have a problem that it says it in the Gemara. I have a problem that when this Gemara is taught, it's taught without problematizing this. It's taught like this is Torah Misinai and without raising the issue. And that becomes a question for us. How do we teach the Akedah? How do we problematize it, given where our sensitivities are? So I want to just share with you, what an approach that I have towards this, which I think is, for me, what I feel the best sort of way of grappling with this. One answer is, you know, not, you don't emphasize the beginning of the story. You have to emphasize nowadays the end. There was a time when the beginning of the story had to be emphasized, that Avram was willing to give up Yitzchak. But nowadays we have to emphasize the end of the story. And the end of the story is that God wouldn't let Avraham sacrifice Yitzchak. The end of the story is that God will never ask us to do such a thing. And that ultimately God was demonstrating, you might be prepared to do it, but that is never something that God will demand of you. And actually, there's a pasuk that says, you know, Asher lo tzivisi v'lo al talibi, relating to child sacrifice. I never commanded and never even was a thought in my mind, that Chazal is referring to the Akedah Yitzchak. That we have to understand that that was never a possibility. God would never have commanded it. So that the message we have to be teaching is not look what Avraham was ready to do, but the message we have to be teaching is look at what God will say is never acceptable. Taking another life for the sake of God is never acceptable. However, I don't think that goes far enough, because we can't ignore still what Avraham was ready to do in the beginning of the story. So let me tell you what I think for me is an answer, or a beginning of an answer. And that's the fact that not only Avraham might have been in the beginning prepared to listen to God, but by the end of the story, whose voice does Avraham hear? An angel calls out to Avraham, Min HaShemayim, right? And the angel says, Al Tishlach Yadcha El Hanar. Now, if Avraham was really being frum, Avraham would have said, excuse me, I heard directly from God that I'm supposed to bring Yitzchak as a sacrifice. You can't override God. If God wants to override what God said, let God tell me directly. It would have been probably the more frum thing to do, right? Why listen to an angel? But Avraham chose not to do that. Avraham actually chose to listen to the angel to countermand the command of God. And I think what that teaches us, what I would like to understand, is that it is almost never that our tradition speaks to us in a univocal voice. there are always softer voices in the tradition. There might be a dominant voice that says, Kach nach bincha yichidcha. But if you listen closely enough, you'll hear the other voice of the angel that says, Al tishlach yadcha el hanar. And that actually, the greatness of Avraham was that he was able to hear the voice of the angel. That he was able to hear that voice and attend to that voice and understand that that voice told him how he had to understand, how he had to interpret God's command. You know, there's an interesting Rashi, a little bit of a rabbinic Rashi. And Rashi says, you know, how does God say, take him for an olaf? In the end, he said, don't do it. He says, no, I didn't really mean slaughter him. I meant lift him up, put him on the altar, and then take him down. Nice little reinterpretation. And maybe that's exactly what the challenge is to be able to hear the angel's voice and to understand that we always have to hear that voice of fundamental morality and be prepared to bring that in our role of how we understand and interpret what God said. So God didn't say to slaughter him. God just said, bring him up, now you bring him down. And in a way, that's really the tradition of Torah Shabbat Peh. You know, Chazal in so many ways interpret and understand the divine command through the lens of a sense that God would never ask us to do certain things. So that role of interpreting God's command, ayin tachas ayin, doesn't mean literal. Katzotat kapa, cut off the hand of a woman that intervened to save her husband, that's not literal. That can't be what God is asking us. You don't understand. What God is actually telling us is you pay money. God is actually saying something different. Yes, the dominant voice says, kach et bincha, but the angel's voice is telling us, al tishach yadcha lanar. And it's our obligation to hear the angel's voice, and that is how I would like to understand is the message that we can learn from the story.
I just want to flesh out some of the moral problems here, some of which Robert Linzer alluded to, and then also perhaps respond to something he said there towards the end. Obviously, the story is raising fundamental questions about faith as opposed to ethics and morality. Is there such a thing as an absolute duty to God? A duty that's so absolute that it takes precedence over any other concern, even the loftiest sort of moral obligation. I think the problem can be quickly understood if you compare the attitudes of two philosophers to the Akedah, one of whom Rabbi Linzer alluded to. So for somebody like Immanuel Kant, universal moral standards are supreme. Everyone, including and actually especially God, has to play by the same moral rules. Don't kill means don't kill. It means that in every situation there are no exceptions. There's no sudden suspension of this idea for divine command. In fact, for Kant, God would never ask such a thing. So it's obvious that Avraham is really the villain of the piece, that he misread divine intention, that he heard wrong. That if you hear God telling you, go out and kill an innocent person, you better rethink it because it is not God who's speaking to you. That's Kant's take. And for Kierkegaard, who's a sort of radical Danish Protestant thinker, obviously by ordinary ethics, Abraham is a murderer, but faith is not an ordinary realm of life. And here, and I don't think this is particularly Jewish, actually, I think Kierkegaard begins to split off radically and unequivocally faith from morality and sees them as two separate domains. So one thing that's very striking in Kierkegaard is that he distinguishes Avraham from what you might call the usual tragic hero. If you look in like Greek myths or even other kinds of tales, so what's a tragic hero? A tragic hero is somebody who has to sacrifice something or someone very beloved to him for the sake of some higher moral duty. So you have, for instance, Agamemnon, who sacrifices his daughter Iphigenia, so that the Greeks can win the Trojan War. So, or you have Brutus, who puts his sons to death because they're plotting against the state. But it's totally different with Avraham, right? Because he seems to be sacrificing his child not in the name of some higher moral ethic, but for no ethic at all, save just obedience to this supreme being. So if you look at Kant and you look at Kierkegaard, it seems like there's problems both ways. So the Kantian view in which Abraham doesn't realize that God would never break the moral law assumes that God is constricted inside of ordinary human ethics and can never break free of them. So, in other words, the phrase that sounds appealing, that God plays by the same moral rules as us, also is problematic. What does it mean that God has to play exactly by the same moral rules as me? Kierkegaard's view is that God operates on a different plane and that at any moment can just say, I know what the actual rules are ordinarily, but I'm suspending them today and just listen to me. But think about the potential for the corruption inside of that scheme. Something you alluded to, that a fundamentalist can come and can take this and say, you know, I got to murder hundreds of innocent people because God spoke to my ear and said, you've got to do that. I note that a couple of months ago, Yigal Amir's brother was let out of prison after being jailed for 16 years. And he came out totally unrepentant about the assassination and basically said defiantly that him and his brother were following the way of the Lord, and this is a mitzvah. And on some level, I'm thinking, this is the problem with Kierkegaard, right? Somebody says, ordinary ethics don't apply here. I'm following the voice of the Lord. Although for the emirs, they would say that it was the moral thing to do. So it's not quite Kierkegaardian. So as you pointed out, one of the things people do then is they step back from the brink and they reinterpret. And here, I think there's a whole problematic as well. What do reinterpretations do? Reinterpretations take original texts that are really, really troubling to us and try and make them relevant to moderns. That's a technique I deeply respect because you want to take Torah and make it palatable to people. You don't want what I sometimes call an indigestible or unusable Torah. So you have people, even back to the 50s, Ishai Leibowitz, who writes that halakha is the Jew's everyday akedah. A lovely sort of take. You know that the Jew every day has to follow the demands of halakha, and this is a yoke that's placed on him. But it's obviously quite a leap from sticking a gun into your child's mouth and you're about to pull the trigger. It's clearly not the same thing. Very strikingly, even more radical reinterpretations took place in modern Israeli literature. And here I'd like to read you a couple of things in which they're comparing the Akedah to the sacrifices that parents are making in Israel, sending their children off to war. So, in fact, the Akedah in modern Israel becomes a form of protest literature. And this gained strength especially, it was even there before 67, but after the first Lebanon War, it gained a lot of power. So, for instance, Yehuda Amichai, in his poem Hagibor HaMiti Shel Akedah, the true hero of the Akedah, writes the following. The true hero of the Akedah was the ram. Unaware of the connivance of others, it volunteered, as it were, to die in Isaac's place. The angel went home, Isaac went home, and Abraham and God went long ago. But the true hero of the Akedah was the ram. So this very sort of anti-heroic, undermining, sort of subversive text. Other poems, even angrier, there's one by Yitzhak Leor entitled HaMitzumtam Hazeh Yitzhak, this fool, comma, Isaac, in which he writes, from the Negev to Mount Moriah to be sacrificed? To trust a father like that? Let him, Isaac, kill him, Abram, first. Let him slam his father, his only father, Abraham, in jail, in the poorhouse, in the cellar of the house, just so he will not kill. Right? So a sense of outrage at this, what seems unnatural for the, you know, son to die first. The ending of the story. So the ending of the story is, in my way of thinking, actually one of the biggest problems in the story. It doesn't make anything for me go away. Let's just think about the moment where it stops. Emmanuel Levinas actually writes that Abram obeyed the first voice is astonishing, but that at sufficient distance with respect to that obedience to hear the second voice, that is essential. In other words, as you say, he was able to take himself away from this idea of what God wants from me. And there's a suggestion, Levinas, that actually what moves Yitzchak is already there before the command of the angel, before the angel asking to reconsider, that when he's standing on the altar over Yitzchak and sees his face, that that's a humanizing moment, and that already you cannot do what the abstract command is asking you to do. That even before the angel is saying, Avram, Avram, and sort of shaking him out of this focus on killing that the very encounter with Yitzhak makes it different. And this receptivity to the other, that's the Levinasian language, this receptivity to the other is already having an effect on Avraham prior to withdrawing. But for me, I wonder about the aftermath of this story, right? There's many people in Jewish thought who like to talk about the happy ending, but it's not happy at all. If you take a child and you put him on an altar and you put a knife to his throat and you stop and you say, oh, let's not do that. Just kidding. And you unbind him, the damage is already done. The Chumash is actually remarkably frank about the fact that the damage is already done because of its continuous narrative of intergenerational trauma that ensues. This has a ripple effect that lasts for generations, right, I would say, until the descent into Mitzrayim. And then there's, just to close, this very poignant Rashi in the first pasuk of Chafzayin where, you know, they're about to, you know, Yitzchak is blind and he's about to be, you know, fooled by Yaakov, and Rashi brings down the Midrash about why his eyes grew dim. And one of the three explanations there is that when Yitzchak was on the altar, his eyes were open and the angels wept tears into his eyes, and he's sort of been holding on to this trauma for all of these years, and then the blindness kicks in at an older age. And that's a sort of a metaphor for the idea that he didn't just leave the altar and it was all okay. Very sort of striking separation of this entire family, right, that after the Akedah, first Midrash and Chayesara, that Sarah dies of a heart attack, these family members in the text never speak again. Yitzchak does not talk to Avram. Avram does not talk to Sarah. Sarah does not talk to Yitzchak. There's a sort of deliberateness in which they're gone. And of course, they don't go home together, right? It seems like Avram goes home with the servant boys. Yitzchak, we don't know where he is. There's even a very sort of legend of the Middle Ages that the Ibn Ezra quotes that he was killed and resurrected. But in any case, there seems to be isolation, separation, trauma. So even though the command is reversed, it doesn't end there. My one thing that I was wondering about what you were saying is that it's quite true that moderns cannot just ingest wholesale what the ancients say, because it's problematic. But then there's a new problematic that ensues, which is that if we're going to historicize texts and we're going to reinterpret them, there's a sort of slippery slope angle that kicks in, right? In other words, where are we going to stop now? You mentioned slavery, you mentioned the Akedah. How do we make, that makes the decision even harder. In a way, it's cleaner and easier just to say, let's stick with the original meanings. That way we don't have to pick and choose how we historicize them. How would you respond to that? In other words, how do we begin to adjudicate which stories we can strip of their ancient baggage?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess to respond directly to that and then also to mention one or two other points, I'm not sure, you know, you presented it as though the ancient baggage, the original meaning of the text, is divine command over morality. But again, I would challenge that, and I would say that that's being read through a modern lens, that I actually think the original meaning is non-problematic. It doesn't see this as a moral issue, that the original meaning is not that divine command wins out over morality, that the original meaning is that divine command should be prepared to give that which is most dear to us. So I think morally problematizing it is something that comes through modern eyes. Now, of course, I agree that it's morally problematic, but I don't think that that was the message of the text. I think that the seeing it in this morally problematic way is a more recent perspective of it.
Let me just get clear on what you're saying. Are you saying that it wasn't morally problematic then because Avram didn't hear it that way, or the culture surrounding wouldn't hear it that way? Because
The second, let me ask you, let's say the text was, I want you to take this slave that has been conquered in this battle and to enslave this person. So would you have said, how are you supposed to listen to God to do something so morally problematic as enslave another human being? I don't think you'd be bothered with that because you would say, no, at the time that was completely a non-morally problematic issue. Now I think and objectively it was wrong, and it was wrong even then. You know, it might be that morality is not just a subject of norms, but I can accept that it wasn't perceived as such at that time.
Okay, so now I follow. So I'm still wondering on that level. In other words, if we say that Avram is the paradigm of somebody who transforms himself out of a pagan mindset, which seems to be, you know, the way the Rambam is looking at it and so forth, then wouldn't he have already internalized the ethos that you don't do this to your children? In other words, that's the pagan way, child sacrifice, self-mutilation, monotheism is about something else. So at that point in the story, why wouldn't it be problematic for him?
Did he still have slaves? I mean, Hagar was a slave,
probably,
right?
But in other words, that aspect of paganism, one would think he would already have. In other words, if we talk about
it. I think you're bringing a modern sensibility to it. I mean, I think we're living in the post-Akedah world where God has said this is not part of my agenda. But who knows what was true in the pre-Akedah world? Who knows if that had yet been a clear part of what divine ethical monotheism was until God had communicated that in the Akedah?
So you see this as an influx process, that he's still coming to what a full understanding of monotheism would be?
Yes, I see that the message of the Akedah is it's not yet clear this is morally problematic, but it's still asking this one child that you've waited 100 years to have, and what's going to happen about God's promise, and all of your hopes are in this one child, and you're being told, Bincha Yechidchun, give him to me. After the Akedah, the message is, this is not ever a part of divine monotheism. This is a pagan practice. So I'm not arguing that it's deeply, you know, right, that obviously I share the moral, recoil of that, but I just don't know if that's pshat of the story. So, I mean, that would be my first point. So I'm not sure, you know, who is reinterpreting, making it a moral problem in situ might be a reinterpretation as well. In terms of the question about where do we draw the line, look, you know, you could ask that about the whole process of Torah Shabbat Peh, because really what I'm saying is that the ongoing role, I mean, I think that's, to, you know, a nice phrase that Dr. David Schatz, I don't know if people know him, but he's, you know, a philosopher, Jewish philosopher, and he actually has dealt with this issue as well, and he had a nice phrase. He said, how do we teach the Akedah so Akedah doesn't become Al-Qaeda? You know, a nice little turn of phrase. And obviously, you know, the teaching the Akedah nowadays is, you know, if it were ever deeply morally problematic, we have to be highly sensitive to it. I think that, let's say somebody said, well, where do you draw the line when you're, you know, how flexible can halacha be? What are the parameters? You know, you're always reinterpreting, and the Chazal are reinterpreting the Torah, and the Rishonim are reinterpreting Chazal, and the Achronim. So, you know, where do you know what the parameters are? I mean, I think that that's part of the ongoing human-divine engagement, and I think in a way, you know, look, to some degree, we don't have the history of violence in the name of God against other people because we have been disempowered for 3,000 years. So we can't necessarily take pride in the fact that we didn't have the opportunity. Right. But at the same time, I would like to believe that our fact that we have a Torah Shabbat Peh tradition, which has always been sort of infused and shot through with a moral sensibility in the way that it approaches the Torah and that it reads the mitzvot of the Torah, is, you know, something which ensures that the divine command will always be heard, or hopefully always heard in a certain way. So can I tell you exactly where to draw the line? I don't know. But I can certainly see that that is part of the process of the Torah Shabbat Peh. So that's at least what the message I'd like to hear from this.
It's all yours. If you wish it to be.
Yes. Right.
What is this? In what way has God's relationship with Abraham been changed through this death? Because it was all eventually
Well, I think that the fact is that he was, again, we can't bracket, for us, we can't bracket the murder, the potential, the almost murder and the moral aspect. But nevertheless, to bracket that for a moment, the point is that you were willing to give up what is most dear. Okay, so, and that is Yireh Elokimata. And I think it's worth noting that, because while one time I say, you know, we have to teach this in a message that is, we can never hear God commanding us to do something like that. We always have to hear the angel's voice. But I think there's another problem if we're always problematizing it in terms of the moral problem and speaking about the problematics, that we're never hearing the Kiyirei Elokimata. And I actually want to read you something from Jacob Katz, who deals with the fact that in Ashkenaz, in the Middle Ages, during the Crusades, they were very ready to give up their lives to serve God, to, you know, not to convert to Christianity. And they were even willing to take the lives of their own children when they thought that they might be converted. And that very often this has been, they described it themselves as an akedah. And they described the taking of their lives of their own children as an akedah. And there's a lot to say about that. But it was not the case in Sfarad. In Sfarad, as we know, very often people, rather when it was, when it was extremist Islam that was in the time of the Rambam and other times, you know, sometimes in Christian times, that very often in Sfarad they were more prepared to at least do a surface conversion rather than to give up their lives, even when halacha demanded it. So whereas in Ashkenaz they might have taken it to, or they did take it to an extreme, and it wasn't just giving up their lives, but it was taking the lives of their own children. In Sfarad, they often did not do what halacha demanded, and they did not give up their lives. And here's the line that Jacob Katz says describing that. I just want to read it to you. He says, this is in Exclusiveness and Tolerance. He says, the factors making for the willingness to submit to martyrdom were not exclusive to Ashkenazic Jewry. They were present in all dispersed communities of traditional Jewish society, and they provide powerful enough to evoke the moral courage necessary to face martyrdom, so long as the attachment to tradition was not enfeebled through the undermining influence of rationalism or of other spiritual or social factors. The Ashkenazi Middle Ages were not exposed to such subversive forces. So we often, you know, say, how horrific is it that they took the lives of their children? And we are deeply morally offended, as I think we should be. But sometimes I think we allow that sort of rationalism and profound sense of like, God forbid, you know, that we should ever do something like this, to lead to a certain cold, dispassionate approach towards our sense of our obligation to God and our obligation to religion and our sense of self-sacrifice and being willing to give up things for God and for the service of God. I think, you know, if I could speak, I think as the modern Orthodox community, we are less passionate, more rational, maybe more moral, but less passionate in our service of God. And I think that we have to be honest that that's the trade-off. So I think sometimes the message, after we've dealt with the most obvious issue about the moral issue, the message is, are we prepared to say, you know, Kiyirei Elokimata, not because you weren't prepared to sort of take your son, but were you really prepared to give up? Are you prepared to give up what is most dear to you, not take a life, but to really make profound self-sacrifice to serve God? And I don't think that's a message we communicate well enough within our community. So, and I think that that is really what the text is getting at, if we can get beyond the murder aspect, you know. Right. So I think a standard question that's is asked is, here he is by Sodom, he stands up and he argues with God, and by the Akedah he follows silently. So I'll tell you what I think. I'll first give you a sermonic answer, and then I'll give you an answer which is, I think, pshat. Okay. The sermonic answer, the musr is, I would say, that how do we deal with it when we feel that something that Torah or halacha or God demands from us is somehow offensive to our sense of right and wrong? Do we object? Do we not do it? Do we go ahead and do it? What's our response? And it might make a difference, because, you know, if we have a vested interest in it, how do we always know that our sense of, you know, moral objection is really an honest moral objection, and it's not a way of really saying, you know, somehow expressing a sense that we don't want to do it for other reasons because something is at stake for us in the matter. And that maybe one thing we can understand is that when Abraham did not have a vested interest, he was on more secure ground to sort of argue against God in terms of the morality of it. When it was about something that he was asked to give up of himself, perhaps to argue about the morality of it could be somehow seen as compromise, because maybe it was really not about the morality. Maybe it was about, maybe he couldn't be sure. Maybe it was because he didn't want to actually do what God had asked. So that's the sermonic answer. But even within the sermonic answer, I will tell you, it's not so cut and dry. Because sometimes we really only begin to understand the deep moral problematics when it actually touches us. You know, as was stated in the name of Levinas, you know, when you see the face of the other in the abstract, maybe you don't feel the moral problematics. When it really hits home, you feel it. I'll give you an example. There's a profound tshuva. I'm trying to remember who. I think it's the Chavos Yair, but I could be incorrect, about the question of, can a blind person get an aliyah? So it's an interesting question. How much is the person who's getting the aliyah just there to make the brachot? And how much is that person supposed to be as if they're reading from the Torah? So if they're blind, you can't say that they're reading from the Torah. So the Shulchan Aruch rules that a blind person cannot get an aliyah. Comes, again, I forget, I believe the Chavos Yair, it might be another great posek, and he says, you know, I didn't have a problem with that psak in general. And then he says, actually quoting by Yitzchak, he says, now that I've grown old, and I've lost my sight, and I feel, how could this happen? How could I be excluded from Nachalat Hashem and from the Jewish community, you know, not to be able to have a portion in reading the Torah? So this is how he felt. I mean, some of us might feel, big deal, I don't get an aliyah. But he felt this was basically saying, you're no longer a full member of the Jewish community. You no longer have a portion in the Torah. And therefore, says, therefore, I took it upon myself to look at all the sources and to go back and to revisit all this. And even if the Shulchan Aruch rules that it's not okay, I'm going to show you why it is acceptable. So on the one hand, you could say, very nice, he's doing it because he wants to get an aliyah. But on the other hand, you could say, no, now he really realizes it, what that means to be excluded, and now he's giving the type of moral response that that issue requires. So even at the sermonic level, I'm not sure we could so easily say, oh, if you're not Nogei Bedavar, you have more of a place to stand on than if you are Nogei Bedavar. So that's the sermonic answer. But I think at the pshat level, I have to tell you, I'm not really so bothered. I think that the normal way those two stories are read are both incorrect. I think reading the Akedah that it was somehow, as I said, the issue was morality versus divine command is a modern read, and that wasn't how it was perceived of at the time. And I think reading the story of Sodom and Amorah, that Avram is taking his own morality and challenging God, is also a modern read and not a correct read. I think the Torah is very clear that Avram challenges God, not because Avram knows it's not right, but because God knows it's not right. Because Avram says to God in the story of this Sodom and Amorah, Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo ya'aseh mishpat. And the story is introduced with God saying that I know Avraham because he will teach his family v'shamru derech Hashem lasot tzedakah u'mishpat. The way of God is the way of justice. Avraham is calling God on God's own standards. God, you have said you deal justly. This is not just. So I actually think, and one, how it's powerful to put those stories up against one another, but I don't think at a pshat level they're saying what we read them to normally say.
I think one interesting thing to ask yourself on your question is, do you feel that Avram has gone up or down in terms of his standing in your eyes in the two stories? Because it's sort of a Rorschach of interpretation. If you look at Yeshaya Leibowitz's interpretation, he puts those two stories together and says that Avram has gone up. Right? In other words, he says that, you know, at Sodom he was at a certain spiritual level, but really he's on a much higher level now. And that's why he gets the, you know, the approbation, Yer Elohim, and so forth afterwards. If you look at David Hartman's interpretation of the story, Avram's gone down. That at Sodom, because that's the way Hartman wants to look at that kind of negotiation, where you're, you know, there's the integrity of your own self and your own sort of assertiveness before God, and that in a way to go mutely in the second instance is not the way to go. And so it's in a way telling you as much about how the interpreter wants to see the text as it is about the actual facts of the text themselves. I wanted to ask about the connection here between Rosh Hashanah mm-hmm. and the Akedah. Why, besides the obvious, the shofar, the horn, and so forth, why you think that the story is placed for the second day Kriya?
Yeah. Again, I mean, I might be sounding here, I might be sounding a little like a broken record, but I really do think that until, relatively in the modern period, the message is the first day we read Vashem Pakad et Sarah, Barash Hashanah Nifkida Sarah, and that this is a day of remembrance and look at what God has given us. And at the second day, we sort of remember the zechut of the Akedah, which is that we sort of acknowledge that our responsibility is to be prepared to sacrifice for God. Avraham was prepared to sacrifice. Throughout Jewish history, we have sacrificed for God. Meaning it's not cast in this, again, morality versus divine command. It's cast as what do we give in our service of God? And that merit should stand for us. And I think that's how it's embodied in the liturgy. So the problem is, the question is, how do we continue to teach what it's doing in the Akedah? Mm. Not historically, why was it, why is it there? But how do we continue to communicate the message of that? And I have to tell you, I'm very conflicted because, I don't know how everybody here is hearing what I'm saying. Like, you're going away saying, oh, so Rabbi Linzer isn't really bothered about the morality of the Akedah. I'm certainly not saying that. I mean, I'm sort of horrified as everybody here. But the question is, I can sort of understand it in context. The challenge that I face is, what is the message we teach? So one message I teach when we're dealing with the moral issue is listen to the angel. But the other message that I'd like to teach, and I don't know if I can teach at the same time, is be prepared for self-sacrifice. Have passion in serving God. Don't always be so rationalistic. Obviously, on the one hand, be moral and don't cross moral lines, but also be prepared to passionately give of yourself. And I don't know if I can teach both messages, because as soon as you try to start teaching this other message, which I think the modern Orthodox community needs to hear, you undermine the first message, which is if God seems to be saying that to you, you gotta stop and listen and reassess. So I really struggle with what's the lasting message of how do we, not why was it placed there, but how do we communicate why it's placed there. Maybe I'll read just very briefly one other brief text, because with all of the akedot that we read in the slichot, the message is almost consistent in all of those slichot, which is Avraham did it willingly, Yitzchak did it willingly, nobody had a problem with it, so we should all be prepared to, this is an amazing thing, and then ideally we should be prepared to do the same as well. Now, first of all, there's a problem. If they didn't have a problem with it, then what type of a test was it? Number one. But number two is, of course, how do we deal with that issue? So it's worth noting that actually every day in the Slichot, almost we don't even notice it because it's towards the end and it's a little part of a section which is somewhat repetitive, so maybe we're not even listening to what we're saying. But near the end, and this is probably one of the earliest Slichot, it's essentially in a Mishnah in Ta'anit. It says, Mishana l'Avram avinu b'har ha-moriah hu ya'anenu. Mishana l'Yitzchak b'no k'shene'akad agav ha-mizbeach hu ya'anenu. The God who listened to Avraham at Har HaMoriah shall answer us. The God who listened to Yitzchak when he was placed on the Mizbeach shall answer us. What was God listening to? Where was Avraham praying? Where was Yitzchak praying? Well, who was God listening to? I think the very inescapable message of that is that they were praying to God to intervene. And God responded. So one of the slichos we say every single day is that they were prepared to do it in one sense, but they couldn't accept what they were about to do. And they prepared to God, and God actually was prepared to intervene. So, I do think that we have to be raising those issues, but it's an ongoing challenge. Again, the first step is to problematize it, not to pretend as if this is that this is a simple message. Well, that's what it says. It ends. There are some moderns who want to read it like, either they want to read he failed the test, because he was prepared to, and then what do you do with now? I know that you're God-fearing, or I know that you're God-fearing, you know, somehow, you know, because you didn't want, because you listened to the angel. But it actually says, Atayadati ki re Elohim ata, I know you're God-fearing, v'lo chasachtes binchas yichidcha mimeni, you did not hold back your son, your only son, from me. So it's very hard to escape the pshat meaning of that text. Right. Right. Yeah, it's a tough one.
Yeah, I don't think they're opposites. Before I answer that, I just want to take one step back. The authors of Slichot, of course, are acting as moderns,
mm-hmm.
right? Because what they're doing is they're stepping in for us and actually expressing the exasperation
mm-hmm.
that we feel when actually Avram does not seem to be saying anything in the text.
Right.
And you have all of these later post-biblical texts that are stepping in and giving voice
mm-hmm.
to the voiceless, right? So everybody, in a way, has been a modern when it comes to this text, trying to pull out of it
yeah.
what does not seem to be happening, which is why isn't Avram screaming and kicking?
Right.
As far as passion versus rationality, they shouldn't be dichotomous. I don't think that that's actually the dichotomy in the modern Orthodox community.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's between passion and rationality. I think it's between passion and autonomy, sometimes indifference, masquerading as autonomy. So I understand what you mean when you say, you know, when we associate modern Orthodoxy with a sort of more intellectual bent and so on. But that all comes from breathing in the autonomous fumes of the last 200 years. There's just a basic assault on religion that took place. I also don't necessarily associate passion
mm-hmm.
with, quote, the other community. I think all of these words are in a way very tricky. I mm-hmm. think that there's a lot of external piety that gets mm-hmm. produced in certain communities and a lot of autonomy that gets produced in other communities. So I'm not sure that I necessarily would use these words. I think that I do agree very wholeheartedly, though, with this idea of self-sacrifice. I think that's crucial. How much are we really given to give? That's not comfortable for us. Nobody's going to give their child now. But are we able to give something that is really uncomfortable for us, that lies at the heart of what I wouldn't like to give? But part of the problem here also is that I don't know that people are unwilling to sacrifice something, but they want to know why. There's a very Job-like aspect
mm-hmm.
to this where, okay, so you want to take something away from me, but tell me what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, it's not like an EO of God does tell him what to go on. It's really almost four chapters of shut up
mm-hmm.
At the end. But so I think that everybody, I think, is quite capable mm-hmm. of making sacrifices. But today's person sort of wants to know why, and to just say to them, believe, that's where the difficulty lies.
Well, so let me respond to that, because so I certainly agree that we can sometimes tend to romanticize the more Haredi community, and that, you know, there's a lot that's not so romantic and not so ideal there. But I do think we have a problem with passion. You know, how many modern Orthodox Jews do you know that really get into their davening? I don't just mean shuckle a lot, like really spend time to feel and to connect and to work on their connection to God. Somehow we feel, you know, it's not so. I mean, I have all these questions about God. Do I believe in God? Do I believe in a personal God? What does it really mean to be talking to God? Somehow all of that philosophizing gets in the way of the immediacy of a religious experience. And I do think that that is something that is a challenge for us. In terms of the self-sacrifice, I think as well, an irrational self-sacrifice, you're right, but are we willing to not pursue our, let's say, professional ambitions and spend more time contributing to the Jewish community, right? How many of us are willing to take off years to do something to serve Klal Yisrael rather than to actualize ourselves in this sort of Western ideal of self-actualization and, you know, and professional achievement? So I do think that, you know, even a very meaningful self-sacrifice is something that we have a lot to work on. Yeah, so that's obviously a problem. I mean, no righteous person should ever be killed, but I think Avram's argument was not Avram actually, one can argue that, you know, Avram was a little bit overplaying his hand because, you know, Avram said, how can you wipe out the innocent, you know, the righteous with the wicked? But then he was asking to save the whole city. Right, the only really sort of logical argument is save the righteous. So even when it ended, you know, God says, okay, if there are 10, then I won't, you know, I won't wipe out everything. So presumably, even if there were fewer than 10, maybe God would have saved those individuals. But Avram was really trying to argue to save all of the cities. So in a way, I would reverse the question. Just because there were 10 cities, people, would that justify saving the entire place? You know, and that gets into the idea of 10 representative of a community. It's a city worth saving. There's hope, there's potential, and so on. But I think we have to realize that he was arguing to save the entire city for the sake of the 10.
Well, he changes his argument, right? In the middle. First, it's going to be, you know, on account of the 10, and then it gets, well, we'll save everybody.
Right.
Right, so it shifts, right? The first argument is about the immorality, really, the theodicy of killing good people along with bad people. So from there, you understand that he doesn't care about the bad people, but why should, like, if there's good people there, save the good people? But then suddenly, it shifts in the next pasuk, where he talks about the idea, well, let's just save everybody on account of the good people. So now it's not the division between good and bad. It's a very strange moral switch, really.
Yeah.
Because in the first, you have clarity that good people deserve good and bad people deserve bad.
Right.
Now it's like everybody deserves good because of the good people. Right? So there's a real oddity there. I don't know. I really don't. You know, I think about this story in the context of Gaza. You know, I think of all these situations where, you know, you have collateral damage and you're going to harm good people when you hit the bad people. And there's a real sort of political dynamic that goes on there. But I think it's also difficult to say that we in a way now refrain from doing anything. We're paralyzed because sort of afraid of innocent, you know, people dying, and also not to be able to say clearly, this is good and this is bad. So if you keep going, so relativism awaits at a certain point.
Maybe I'll take a minute just to also introduce. I wanted to mention a slicha because we are, you know, about to read slichot, and I did say that almost all the slichot in the Ashkenazi Siddur treat the Akedah as non-problematic. There's a slicha that's actually written by an Ashkenazi poet, but it's said by the Sfardim, and it actually really problematizes the Akedah, not from, I would say, the sort of, maybe from the moral perspective, certainly from what this, that the sacrifice is just, you know, sort of it's asking too much, whether it raises it as a moral issue per se. So here's what the slicha says. It's the slicha that's entitled Eit Sha'arei Ratzon Lihipateach. And it actually, the message of the slicha is not because Avraham was prepared to do this, you should have compassion on us, but because Avraham and Yitzchak cried out to you, similar to Nisha Anala Avraham Bahar HaMoriah, cried out to you to intervene and you and to open up the gates of compassion, and you opened up the gates of compassion and you agreed to intervene, you should similarly open up the gates of compassion and intervene on our behalf. A very different casting of the message of the Akedah. And here's what it has Yitzchak saying. Listen to this. It says, Sichu le'imi, Yitzchak is talking to Avraham. Actually, the line before says, Vayihim or yomam be'inam layil. The light of the day became as night to them. The light of the day, maybe that's even referring to God. The light of the day became as night. V'hamon d'ma'av nozlim b'chayil. Esav's tears are flowing in power. Ayin b'mar bocha, like the eye is crying in bitterness, but v'lev sameich, it still has the heart being joyous, but listen to the next line. Here's what Yitzchak says. Sichu le'imi, tell my mother, Yitzchak is saying to Avraham there on the altar, ki sisonah pana, her joy will now be removed. She will no longer have any joy in her life. Habein asher yalda l'tishim shana, the son that she gave birth to after 90 years, haya le'esh, was bathed into fire, ulama achelat mana, and to the portion that was slaughtered by the sword. Ana avakesh la menachem, ana, where will I find for my mother a consoler? Tsar li le'em tifker v'titapeach, it is anguish for me that my mother should cry and should be so distraught. So, and it goes on and on in this vein, and the end of it says, Kach imcha hanisha me'afari, Yitzchak is saying to Avraham, take what remains from my ashes, then mor l'sarah zel Yitzchak reach. Go tell Sarah, this is the aroma of your son. So this is what Yitzchak is saying to Avraham. So essentially making a plea, how can you be doing this? What are you going to go back and tell Sarah? What is this going to do to my mother, to your wife? And ultimately, the angels intercede and then God responds. So, you know, this idea about how do we teach the Akedah, it's a very different message here. And I think maybe one of the things we have to be thinking about is like maybe to be, you know, what the which slichot we say. It's not like it's written halacha l'moshe misinai. There's a lot of different traditions of the slichot, and maybe we have to give some thought to, you know, to making some choices in the liturgy that are appropriate.
Okay, Shkayach.
Is that it?
Thank you all very much.
Wait, the rabbi has one last
one more. Okay.
Me personally? Well, I think for me it's what I said. It's that, you know, how I deal with the moral issue. I shared my approach, which is, I think the answer is Torah Shebaal Peh, the voice of the angel, our moral responsibility in partnership with God. How do we listen to the voice of God through listening to the voice of the angel? And then what do I sort of take as the message of, you know, what I learned from Avraham and from the readiness is a greater sense of how do I become more prepared to be more self-sacrificing than I think I'm usually comfortable with, and to have more of not always allow my sort of rationality to be a obstacle between me and giving of myself, and, you know, not just giving of myself in terms of time and energy, but also throwing myself into serving God and not always asking the types of philosophical questions that can cause a distancing from the immediacy of the experience.
Oh, my response will be far less exalted. I will concentrate on being awake while I'm saying it, and I'll remain conflicted, as always. I mean, that's a long, just the whole... I mean, this begs, it's a microcosm of a larger question, which is whether we think of these things as kind of metaphysical magic dust. In other words, that there's an actual metaphysical schut that sort of is channeled down through the generations, or whether we're thinking of it more rationally, rationalistically, as metaphorical. I think for me, just speaking personally, when I daven, if I'm concentrating, one of the things I do in the first parak of Amidah is I try and freeze the avot and actually try and gain a kind of mental picture of who these people are. It actually is helpful to think not of modern urban settings, but to think of desert and just think of these people, you know, plodding their way through a very difficult, stripped down kind of life in the desert and being trailblazers and creating in some level the building blocks of this religion that we've now inherited. So I try and think to myself that, you know, this is the model that I'm trying to follow. And that's, for me, that's the schut avot. It's not the magic dust necessarily. I don't have a quarrel with somebody for whom that works in that way. But I think that we're being given examples. But the problem is, and where the other side of my head kicks in, is that looking at Bereishit is just one long narrative of dysfunctionality, trauma, even the ways that we have wrested the text and made these people into what isn't always obvious in any way from reading the stories. The idea of Avraham as the absolute paradigm of chesed can be challenged in certain situations. The idea that Esav is a terrible man can be challenged. All of it can be challenged. So in many ways, it becomes self-fulfilling. What do we want out of our tradition? How do we want to mold it? Which was part of what I asked you before, because in a way it becomes infinitely malleable then, and infinite malleability is problematic. Infinite rigidity is problematic. So you're trying to figure out, like, how do I make the tradition usable without corrupting it so much that it just becomes a kind of what I want to make of it? And I think that's, you know, we've talked about this many times here, that that's one of the challenges that modern Jews have, which is that if we're going to live with integrity, we have to live with our insights, you know, not necessarily just somebody else's. But if we're too self-conscious about those insights, and we feel like we're self-creating the religion every day, it does not have the gravitas that we require to be able to be faithful servants of Hashem.
See, that's where the rationality gets in the way.
It does get in the way, but we are this is the century we live in. There's no choice. We are this way. And in a way, I also think the romanticization even extends the idea that everybody in the Haredi world is davening with such kavanah. I don't believe that one either.
I didn't mean to suggest that, but I think they're better than we are.
Maybe they are and maybe they're not. I really don't know. I really cannot answer that question. But what I do know is that it's an inescapable paradox. The very thing that makes modern orthodoxy interesting, which is that sort of striving for creativity and intellectual integrity, gets in the way of a simple faith. Mm-hmm. You need almost what Ricoeur called the second naivete. You need to come back afterwards and be able to get back to a faith even after you've been exposed to all of this sort of intellectual gain. But that's much easier said than done. I'm actually not sure how practically that is done. Yeah. I think you need communities that meta-communicate to each other that they are passionate, despite the fact that they're intellectual. And maybe part of it is just establishing ground rules that are uncomfortable for people. You cannot talk here. And if you are, we're not welcome here, etc. Now, we are scared to do that. We're scared to do that because we're scared of hemorrhaging, you know, members and hemorrhaging, you know, people in the community, and because so many people look at shul as a social experience at this point. But that's just one example. The same thing would apply at home, you know, whether parents would really lay down the law of how they want their Shabbat tables to look like and what we want to talk about here and what's not acceptable. So on some level, it requires a certain amount of self-discipline that we seem to have trouble mustering, but that we must muster if we want to have a community worth taking seriously. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Read about the Chumash, but
real being in your life, you know, that you are a creation of, and, you know, thinking of yourself as holy, everything that goes with
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, in what ways do each of you, would you recommend incorporating that into the educational system such that it would have a chance of balancing that rational self-consciousness?
So I'm really glad you said that, because it's a type of a comment that I also make frequently. I think that you're exactly right, that that is a problem. Actually, one of the recent musmachim of my yeshiva, he's a rabbi initial, when he got up to speak recently, he told me, I heard it from a couple of people because they were really taken by the sermon. So he spent the first 3 minutes sort of saying, I have to prepare you. I'm going to talk about a topic that we often don't talk about, that we're embarrassed to talk about. I hope I'm not going to offend anybody. It was going on and on. I want to talk about God. You know, so, and the reality is that in the Orthodox community, we are totally comfortable saying the Torah says, Halacha says, you know, this is the minhag, this is this. But, you know, to say God says, is something like, if we feel very uncomfortable. And I think it has to do with the fact, like, you know, it somehow is a little troublesome to our intellectual sense of, like, do sort of urbane intellectual people really talk about God that way as this entity that we're in conversation with and that is part of our lives. I don't know if there is, you know, any answer to that other than doing it. You know, other than actually starting to talk about that more. You know, when I sort of, you know, you say about, like, saying not just what does halacha demand of us, but what does God demand of us? What does it mean to serve God truly? Not just what does it mean to, you know, fully keep halacha and be shomer Torah and mitzvos. You know, you can say the same things and say it with the word God in it. And actually, it changes how we think about who we are and what our responsibilities are and who we're in relationship with. I think another, if we're going to talk about problems of the modern Orthodox community, I think another problem is that we don't tend to see, I mean, it connects to other things, any obligation outside of halacha. I've checked off all the boxes, I've done what I have to do. That's my obligation. You know, as a broader sense of what does it mean to fully live as a Jew in all aspects of our lives and to fully serve God, to be thinking about God, thinking about serving God, to be finding ways to be, you know, to be religious in all opportunities. I think that we aren't exactly, see God in other people. I think we could learn a lot from certain religious, you know, Christians. I think you see some people that are religious Christians. They have no problem. May God be with you. Thank you so much. I feel so blessed by having had the opportunity to meet you. And maybe we feel like a little awkward when we hear that language, but I think we feel we're talking to somebody who's sincerely religious, and I think we can be envious of it as well. So I really think that there is no answer to that other than to start doing it a heck of a lot more.
I completely agree with the experiential component. I have to say in all honesty that on some existential level, Judaism is the problem. When Christians talk viscerally about God, it's because they have concretized Jesus Christ as a figure. I mean, I've told the story many times that when my children were younger and we were walking to shul on Shabbat morning, we'd walk by a church and they'd have a little message outside, inspirational message outside the church that would change every week. And one week it was, Jesus is your friend. And one of our sons asked me, you know, Abba, what does that mean? And, like, do we have friends in Judaism? He asked me. And I thought it was just a fantastic question, like, really right to the point. Nobody would say, you know, Moshe is my friend, Hashem is my friend. It's speaking to something very deep there. It's speaking to the idea that Christians, obviously, you know, from a Jewish point of view, certainly from a Maimonidean point of view, made a grave error, right? They tried to turn God into a human being. They concretized God. They made him flesh and blood. But there was an enormous, you know, payoff, which is that you're able to feel like you're in contact with this being, and he was real, and he came, and he died for you, and et cetera, et cetera. We are left with an invisible, ineffable, unknowable, and for many people, distant entity. And the question of how to bridge that gap is a major question. But I sort of feel like we have to create, not fake it till you make it, but at least create passionate communities that are at least trying. And I feel very much, you know, that we're not creating, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. we're not even, I've already said that inherently there's a big problem because of this invisible God. And we make it even worse by not creating the conditions to succeed in davening, by not creating a sense of seriousness and of quiet and of sacredness. People walk into synagogues, they treat their businesses like a holy place, and they treat their holy places like a business. Right? So it ends up being self-defeating. So we're not doing ourselves any favors by not attempting to address this problem with the seriousness that it merits. Just one other point. I also think people are demoralized about God because I think that they are associating religion and certain forms of religious behavior and saying things like, so if you think this is what God wants from you, this is what God wants from me, then, you know, the heck with it. Right? So there's this sense of the subversion that takes place every time, quote unquote, we religious people do things that are just so problematic ethically. And I'm not even talking about grave things like sexual abuse, which are obviously, you know, horribly damaging, but not just to the children involved, obviously, but to the entire community. But even in subtle things, business things, politeness, rudeness, I mean, just a whole bunch of things. And the message that gets put across is that if God equals religion and religion equals this kind of behavior, I'm not that interested. I'm out of here. So, I mean, there's just so many ways that we're not doing what we need to do to even give us a chance at something that's already, you know, quite difficult.
If I could just add one sentence to that. When you said that, you know, we've created the problem, I actually didn't think you were going to, well, I agree to the point about Jesus, but I actually thought you were going to make another point, which is by the hyper-focus on halacha, we right. have made that the yes. only thing essentially to be worshipped.
Right.
And, you know, it's interesting in your comment about tefillah, because I would go one step further. In addition to have the seriousness of the Beit Knesset, what about actually saying everybody should take a moment of reflection before you begin Shemoneh Esrei? I mean, we just, for those who are doing, you know, the Daf Yomi just began a section on Tefillah. It said, Chasidim HaRishonim, the early righteous people would spend an hour sitting and mentally preparing themselves before standing in Shemoneh Esrei. But for us, it's like, okay, check, did that one, you know, and it's just about saying the words. So I think it's really about, there are these other religious values that are part of what Yiddishkeit is about, that it's not just halacha, and that we have really shrunk our responsibility just to the realm of halacha. Right. Yes. Right. Well, it's a long-standing debate. You know, it goes back to Rambam, and Rambam very much tried to bring philosophy and theology into Emunah, and he was roundly attacked by many as undermining Emunah, but for some people, he saved Emunah, you know? So for some, he helped purify the faith. Without the Rambam, we would be believing in a God with a body, you know? And because of Rambam, we have, you know, because Rambam brought a rationalist approach, it helped correct the Emunah, or, you know, it helped sort of identify the correct Emunah, I should more properly say. But that issue has been with us for a good long time, you know, exactly that.
Which is such a beautiful passage. And it's so inconsistent with anything one perceives in a modern orthodox community, in which, as you say, God is kind of this American that we don't talk about. And also, I think part of what's happening is that God, passion in general, is not cool in the Sulanese sense. Everything, you live in a world that,
sure.
a cultural world that gives up big things to irony, to distance, to
Yeah.
That's an excellent point. You even see that, I mean, just in a trivial, low culture level, where television shows that were popular, like the apex of popularity, say, Seinfeld, The Simpsons, are all about the trope of irony. They're all about standing back, making fun of, not engaged you know, not showing vulnerability and so on. So, I mean, I think there's quite a lot to that, to what you're saying.
And it is worth mentioning, though, that Rambam, because it's the same Rambam that writes so beautifully about being lovesick, that is this, you know, supreme rationalist. And you mentioned Leibowitz. Leibowitz has a beautiful little volume, The Faith of Maimonides, where he actually deals with that. Like, Rambam is not just a rationalist. The rationalism brings us to God, but ultimately, like, why should we care is the question he asks. Okay, so this is truth, this is God. Why should we care? And there needs to be that emotional attachment and that passion to ultimately fuel why we are, you know, living this type of a life and why we are striving to understand God. So it's they don't have to be in opposition.
I just want to say one last thing. There's a passage right at the end of Ne'ilah where it talks about wanting God to forgive us and redeem us, but without great yisurin.
Right.
And I've always been struck by that because I think it's telling us a profound truth, which is that most people, yisurin, suffering. Most people get serious about relationships with God, tefillah, davening, in crisis. Right? And somehow we have to be able to manage to be passionate without being in crisis. How does one do that? In other words, if a person's life falls apart, death, sickness of a loved one, God forbid, financial crisis, divorce, whatever it is, so then there you see there's this feeling of like needing help, needing the relationship, a little bit more oomph in the tefillah if they're not completely alienated. Then returns to normality and the passion also sort of subsides. And the question is whether we're able to bottle that passion without having to bring ourselves to the brink of crisis every time, because that's not manageable. And I think that's something that we really have to think about. How do we normalize that kind of passion? Anyway.
And maybe I'll just add to that, you know, we have, Baruch Hashem, not always, but, you know, we tend to have things pretty good in terms of our, you know, how our economic, social situation, our liberties, and so on. So somebody actually once said, you know why there's such a problem in terms of in high schools, I don't know, you know, certainly true where I come from, getting kids to care and be serious about tefillah. I says, you're asking them to pray in a language they don't understand, to a God they don't believe in, for things they don't need. And I think that that has something to do with our ongoing challenges about taking religion seriously. Like, you know, sometimes it's just a simple level, why do we need God? And I think that that's a question we have to really work at answering, you know, if we want to be taking God and religion seriously. So I think we'll end here. Okay.
I want to thank you very much, Rabbi Linzer, for coming and sharing your wisdom with us, and all of you for staying up late.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Mohammed. Thank you very much.